Thank you. You are so generous, and thank you for inviting me to your beautiful university with all its lovely trees and all its impressive buildings and all its intelligent students. We have been talking about the way in which a basic and very important mental operation, conceptual integration, makes possible and helps develop human linguistic ability. Now today, what I'm going to talk about is the way in which this operation interacts with two other very well-known human abilities. One is the ability to frame, and another is the ability to conceive of things in terms of small stories, by which I mean a certain number of agents who interact together. And this is easy to follow. A frame is an organizing structure which we use to guide our action. So, for example, we are in a library, and you have a frame for a library. In a library, there are books, and there are librarians, and there are rooms. And you know how to operate in a library because you have a frame for a library. You have a frame for a restaurant, and you have a frame for a taxi cab and getting into it, and so on. Well, these frames are often blended. Now, what do we mean by blending? As you've seen before, I asked you to think about a man who is at a wedding party, and he is a groomsman, and he is doing his job. There's a frame for a wedding. The wedding has the bride and the groom and the wedding. And you know what to do at a wedding because you have a frame for a wedding. And our languages are keyed to frames that we know. So all we have to do is mention a word and or a clause or a phrase, and it calls up a certain kind of frame. And one of the things that we do all the time is blend frames. So suppose this man is at the wedding, but while he's at the wedding, he's thinking that 3 weeks ago he was diving with his girlfriend in search of treasure. Now his girlfriend is not here now, but he can think of both of these things at the same time. And as we've discussed, it's a remarkable problem in cognitive science that he can think about both the wedding and about the diving, despite the fact that they conflict with each other and he could become mistaken. He can do more, as we've seen. He can make a connection. He can make connections across these two different mental spaces. So he can connect the bride to his girlfriend, for example. There's an analogical blend. And of course, he can connect himself diving to himself at the wedding. That's an identity connection, right? Many different kinds of connections. The most important of them we call vital relations. Change, cause effect, time, space, identity, analogy, similarity, representation, and so on. Part whole. Now, he can project, map, if you like, selective structure from the input spaces into a third space, which we'll call the blend. Now, suppose in this blend, he's imagining that he's marrying his girlfriend right here. The wedding comes from one mental space. The girlfriend comes from the other mental space. And they're blended. Now, notice, marrying the girlfriend is not in either of the inputs. Just by putting them together, you already have emergent meaning in the blend. And he can run a simulation and see how he feels about it. Maybe he's never thought of this before. We are very capable of running these mental simulations. Now, I'm going to show you a joke. One of the nice things about frame blends is that on the one hand, some of them are quite universal. On the other, some are highly culturally specific. So not only are frames culturally developed in some cases, the frame blends can be hilarious or very impressive in one culture and unintelligible in another because they're both culturally based, as are the blendings. So here's one. In the United States, we have universities. And in universities, research universities at least, the professors can get tenure. That means they not only have a job, but they get to keep their job, right? But in order to get tenure, you have to go through a tenure review in which you get assessed. So I have tenure. And the people reviewing you for tenure say things like, well, does this person have good scientific practice? Has this person published a lot? Is this person contributed to the community? And so on, right? And so that's one frame, tenure in a university, tenure review. Do you sort of understand this? It's a review of jobs, so you get to keep the job, right? If you have questions, ask me now. It's important to have that concept. How familiar is this to you? Are we okay? Oh, yes, good. Somebody's helping me out. Thank you. Xie xie. So, there's another frame in which you have God. Now, this is a Christian frame, the one I'm going to be using here. There's God and Jesus Christ and the Bible. And you're probably fairly familiar with that. So here's a joke. These jokes come up all the time. There are thousands of them on the internet, but they've always been here. This joke is why God won't get tenure. Right? Now, of course, God is not a professor. And a professor is not God. Right? So you're taking, you can see this, these two very different frames, and you're blending them. And the answer is, he published only one book. Okay? Which is the kind of thing you might say about a professor. But there's this accidental connection with over here in the God frame, because there's the Bible. It's only one book. The Bible means book, right? He published only one book. Of course, it's the most influential book in the West ever, but it doesn't matter. He published only one book. So one of the things that we get out of this blend is how silly the tenure review committee is. I'm going a little fast here, but you see the silliness in the blend, the ridiculousness, the lack of wisdom gets projected back to the input space. Now this is not just a joke. This, or it doesn't have to be just a joke. This can be taken as a criticism of tenure committees, right? So on the basis of the blend, we can develop conceptual structure, judgment, cultural views that we can then impose on the things that we do take seriously, like universities. It was in Hebrew. Now, of course, it wasn't actually in Hebrew. Only part of it was in Hebrew. But, right, this is the kind of thing that somebody might say at a tenure review about a professor. Oh, they didn't publish much. It was an out-of-the-way language that we can't even read. It had no references. Now, this is a very funny thing to say in the United States. Oh, this person is not citing enough people, obviously doesn't know the scientific community. He did not publish it in refereed journals, right? Because you have peer review and your article has to be reviewed and so on. Some doubt he even wrote it himself. This is, of course, because every book of the Bible actually has an author. Maybe it's Moses, maybe it's, you know, St. Mark or St. John. He is not known for his cooperative work. Okay? Now, all of these things are things that we would say about people coming up for tenure in a university system. But when you apply them to God, of course, it's absurd that God wouldn't get tenure because God knows everything, right? But you can develop in the blend this, these sets of connections. My very favorite one is, well, here are some others. When one experiment went awry, he tried to cover it up by drowning all the subjects. You remember the flood that came, right? But my very favorite one is he expelled his first two students for learning. That's Adam and Eve in the garden, right? And they plucked from the tree of knowledge, and so he kicked them out of the garden. Well, you get expelled from a university when you're naughty or you do the wrong kind of thing. Well, this is what I mean by a frame blend. And notice, although this is funny, it develops a point. There's a rhetorical point here. there are inferences that we can carry around. Now here's one from Dante. And in fact, you will find this very generally in Dante's Inferno. Dante's Inferno is a book about just judgment, cosmic judgment. So, and he goes down into hell, guided by Virgil, the author of the Aeneid, and he encounters these people who are in hell. And he asks them how they're doing and how they got there. And this one is Bertrand de Born. Now, Bertrand de Born was a famous poet, singer, Provençal jongleur, and he was also politically active, and he contributed to the war between the English king and the son of the English king, right? In other words, he got father and son to fight with each other, right? Now, he is in the realm of hell for those who violate natural connections, right? Because we would say metaphorically, he divided the father from the son. He split them apart. We say this all the time. Okay, well, the way it works in the Inferno most of the time is that the punishment, I'll try to do this slowly. If you're not getting it, cross your eyes or wave your hand, let me know. Is that you take the sinner and the sin. And there's a metaphor for understanding the sin. And you take the source domain for that metaphor and you impose it literally on the sinner. So here, the sin was to set, metaphorically, to set the father and the son apart, to separate things that should not be separated. And the sin is understood metaphorically as this unnatural separation. That's what the sinner did. So what do you think his punishment is? Who can guess? Come on, help me out. Pretend this is the United States. Who can guess? Yes, he gets separated. His punishment is that his head is cut off his body and he carries his head around in hell. So when Dante is talking to him, he's talking from this head, right? Now notice, this is very interesting. In the sin, what gets separated is the father and the son, not the sinner. But in the blend, the sinner is brought down and the metaphoric, the sinner is brought down from the target and the source domain for the sin is brought down and imposed upon the sinner. This, so he says, because I parted people so joined, that means because I separated the father and the son, I carry my brain, alas, separated from its root, which is in this trunk. Thus is to be seen in me the retribution. In other words, you see the punishment in the sinner. Right? And this is the pattern of cosmic justice. What you did will be imposed upon you, not literally, but by application from the source domain. This runs all over Dante's Divina Commedia. This is how we understand, this is how he represents the nature of sin and fault. Here's one we looked at the other day. If this was said when Bill Clinton was first having no problem with the Monica Lewinsky scandal, if Clinton were the Titanic, the iceberg would sink. Now notice that the one thing you know, this is feels metaphoric, the one thing you know about the Titanic is that it did sink and that icebergs cannot sink. They can be submerged but not sink. So you take some things from the source domain, the Titanic and the iceberg, and down they come into, from that frame, into the blend, and from the political difficulties of Clinton, you take the fact that he's not having any trouble, despite the fact that the various political commentators and other politicians are giving him trouble. They're like the iceberg. No problem for him. He does not sink. The Clinton Titanic does not sink. The iceberg sinks. So the important structure, in fact, comes from the target. So this is a frame blend. And notice that the frame, the two frames, the Titanic hitting the iceberg, it's one frame, Clinton having trouble politically, the other frame, are very, very, very different. And there's selective projection. We bring elements from both of those frames down into one combined frame. But we only bring some things down. And there's emergent structure. Now the Titanic does not sink. Right? Okay. You are digging your own financial grave. Some father says, conservative father says to son who's investing in the stock market, you are digging your own financial grave. So there's the investment frame, and there's the digging the frame grave. And again, this feels metaphoric, but only certain things are projected down into the blend where they are combined, and there's emergent structure in the blend. For example, here, the person who's digging the grave is the one who's going to die, and moreover, does not recognize that he is digging a grave. Okay. Now, let's get one that's a little bigger. There's a very popular book in the United States whose title is Seabiscuit. Now, Seabiscuit was a horse, a racehorse. And Seabiscuit was a horse who raced in 1938. And as you know, that was in the run-up to World War II, and it was just at the tail end of the terrible American Depression. So morale in the United States was not so good, right? Seabiscuit was a kind of lazy horse, and Seabiscuit was going to have to run against a very well-trained, spiffy horse named War Admiral, right? So we have a frame in which you have a race between two horses. This is at human scale. It's just two things they're going to race. But you also have the Allies versus Germany, or the United States versus Germany. That's a different frame, very different frame, right? But these two frames got blended, and I'll read you what this reviewer says. Seabiscuit, an American legend. Seabiscuit tells how an unimpressive older horse with crooked legs and a short tail, in other words, something that shouldn't win, right? Got everything going against it, stole the hearts and minds of the American people during the Depression. In 1938, the number one newsmaker was not Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Hitler. It was a horse that defined the word underdog. That's a little bit of a pun. Underdog means something that's not going to win. Now it's used for a horse. It was the indefinable quality of being game, that's sporty, lively, up for anything, can't be defeated, that captured Americans. As one observer put it, Seabiscuit would rather die than be beaten in a race. Yet, unlike many champion thoroughbreds, his off-track personality was low-key, appealing, and frankly, lazy. He was a glutton for food and enjoyed the friendship of a horse named Pumpkin. In short, he seemed the American every horse. So what's happening is that the so-called American character, a vast thing that runs over millions of people, in a time of war and after depression, is getting blended with the personality of this horse. And the American every horse, the equine version of how we see ourselves. And the race between Seabiscuit and War Admiral was taken as a kind of symbol of the United States as it was going to have to enter, or might have to enter, the war with the very finely tooled German army. Now, we saw some other frame blends, double scope blends, in which the frames clashed. I won't go through it again. Harold in the Purple Crayon, who has a crayon, and what he draws is real. In one frame, there is drawing, In another frame, there is the world, and we understand the difference between them. But in this book, if Harold draws the moon, then it is the moon, and it shines. And if he wants to be in his house, he draws his window, and he's in his house, right? Wonderful emergent structure. I'm pointing out again that this kind of blending is not spectacular, not strange. Children can do it as soon as we're able to test the most popular books for them, do these kinds of things. This is just a basic ability that humans have. And it goes a long way to distinguish us from the other species. Now, here I'm going to begin to talk about the way in which frame blends give us new language, or give us language that can be used in new ways. This is Catullus's sonnet 101. Multas pergentes et multa peraequer vectus adveniat miseras frater ad inferias, ut te postremo dona munere mortes, et mutam nequiquam aloquere canerum. That means, through many peoples and across many seas, I have been carried, brother, to bring you the last rites. He's visiting the tomb of his brother, who died in a distant land, and to give you the last gifts of death, and to speak in vain to your mute ashes. It's important to understand. Ashes are the result of cremating the brother, as in a little urn or something like that. And it's in vain because, of course, the brother cannot answer back. And speak in vain to your mute ashes. Okay? Now, over here we have the brother, and you can talk to your brother. You can talk to a human being. We have that frame, right? Not a problem. And over here we have the ashes of cremation, and we have that frame. And these are two very, very different frames, right? In one, somebody's living, the brother. In the other, there's no brother, they're just ashes, right? But now, in the blend, the ashes are the brother. Catullus is not deluded. He's not having a mental breakdown. On the contrary, we put together these blends all the time to help us manage networks. And now, notice what happens. That just slips right by. But I have put it in red. He, speaking to these ashes, he calls the ashes what? What does he call the ashes? Brother. The word frater, brother, is now a word that you can use for these ashes. That's not because if you look up in the dictionary, it says Latin frater, you know, meaning number seven, ashes. No, it's because in one of the inputs, there are words, there's language, there are linguistic constructions that are attached to some of the structure. And when you project that structure down into the blend, you can bring the language with it to refer to the elements in the blend. So now, brother is grammatical. We're speaking to a scene in which everyone knows there's really no brother, but in the blend there is. And he says, you, te, this little pronoun, and to bring you the last gifts. In fact, it's not just the words. There's a whole conversational structure of address and discourse in the language that now are entirely available in this scene because of the blend. Now, how about mute ashes? Okay, now that's something interesting, because outside of this blend, we don't speak of mute ashes. If I have a fire in my fireplace with the wood log and the ashes have fallen and I tell my sons, clean up the ashes, I can't say clean up the mute ashes. Or if I do, that is telling them that I want to do a blend. Because the word mute is for something who can't speak, even though it used to be able to, or it can, but for some reason has stopped, or the normal version of that thing can speak. Right? Mute is only for something that in some way is expected to be able to speak. Right? So you can't refer to mute ashes in the fireplace. But now, and in vain address your mute ashes. That's regarded as particularly meaningful. Why? Because in the blend, this is also the brother. Not entirely the brother, selective projection. So we could, anytime you go through human language, but especially in various kinds of poetry, which I use because it shows you things that otherwise we're inclined not to see, what you see is a use of language that is made possible by the projection of that language down from inputs into the blend for meaning that is in the blend. Right? So brother, you, and mute all acquire here a perfectly natural use. Remember, words don't mean. Words are prompts to get us to construct meaning. It would be a mistake to say, gee, what is it about the word brother in the dictionary that lets us apply it to ashes? That's not the way to look at it. It's how is it that conceptual integration is prompted by various kinds of linguistic constructions, and how do we naturalize expressions, understand them, because we can do conceptual integration. Now notice, in the compressed blend, we often get these kinds of locutions. So for those of you who have been at other lectures, you saw me talk about Racine's Phaedra, who is speaking to Hippolytus and imagining that Hippolytus saved them from the Minotaur and that Phaedra helped him instead of Ariadne. You won't understand a word of this if you weren't at the other lectures or aren't a specialist in Racine. But she says a thread, that's the thread of Ariadne, would not have satisfied your lover. Now, your lover, votre amante, is Phaedra in the blend. It's completely impossible in the input spaces. But now your lover becomes a phrase that can, in fact, refer to Phaedra, right? But it's the same thing as mute ashes. Mute ashes now picks out something in the blend. And it's important to see here that one of the purposes of talking about the blend is not just to talk about the integrated packet. It's so we can understand the whole network. We don't have to have language, new language for the whole network. No. We just have to have enough language to pick out what's in the human scale blend. Wallace Stevens has a poem, The Snowman. This is a frame blend. Here's a frame for a human being. And here's a frame for snow that has been fashioned in the form of a human being. And of course, they have analogy connectors because the snowman doesn't really look very much like a man, right? It's got three round balls. You know, snowman is made three balls of snow, and you put the big one on the bottom, and the middle one in the middle, and the small one on the top, and you put a hat on the top one, and a little charcoal for the eyes and so on. But there is an analogy of form topology. Well, Wallace Stevens' poem blends human intentionality and cognition with the snowman. And now what you get in the blend is not just a snowman, you get a special snowman. This is a snowman who has some abilities to think. Now, this is not a fantasy. The purpose of doing this is not to have a little story about a snowman that came to life. It's to get us to think about who we are. Right? One of the things that this poem can be read as saying is that we always have our desires. We are something, and we impose them on what we see. Right? But the snowman is nothing. And so the snowman is not blinded or misled by imposing his own preconceptions on what he's looking at. So the snowman, in a way, is a better perceiver than we are. He's a listener who who listens in the snow and nothing himself, beholds nothing that is not there and the nothing that is. So because he's a snowman and not a real man, and he is not full of things the way we are full of things, he does not project the things that are inside him onto what he sees or hears. So he sees nothing that is not there, and we do. And the purpose of this, one purpose of this, is to get you to think, to get us to think about how we operate. You can't be a snowman, but you can sort of put together the blend and imagine it. And then again, this can project back up to the input and give you some different ideas about maybe how you should operate. Just the way God won't get tenure can give you different judgment about tenure review committees. This is all over the case, all over the place in nominal compounds. So I'm going to use some examples today that might be mildly offensive, but we're linguists and we must study what people do. We look at weeds as much as at flowers because we're scientists. And this is a memorable example. Jailbait is a nominal compound that I heard applied all the time in my youth. I'm happy to say that I have now seen a movie in which it was applied to a man. That is, a 16-year-old boy. In my youth, I only ever heard it applied to 15, 16, 17-year-old girls. Now, jailbait was a phrase that was used to refer to an underage girl that an of-age man finds sexually desirable. So what does it mean to be underage? Well, in the United States, there are laws about you can't, no matter what happens, you can't have sexual relations with somebody under a certain age. They're called minors. And this was particularly emphatic in the case of older men having sex with younger girls, even if the older man was 19 and the girl was 16. But especially if the older man were 25 and the girl were 16. This is called jailbait. Now, jail comes from the domain of human criminality, and bait comes from fishing, right? These are two very different things. Jail is where you put the criminal. Bait is what you put on the hook to fish with. Two very, very different frames. Notice that jail is not the counterpart of the bait, right? In these nominal compounds, you often get a word from one frame and a word from a different frame, and in they come to suggest a blend. Now, in this blend, the girl is the jailbait, right? Now, there's enormous selective projection, and one of the things this does is give us, again, a tight human scale blend. So over here, in the case of the sexual attractiveness, there can be a long series of causations, a lot of people, different moments. It can take a long time. There can be all kinds of consequences. It's diffuse in the criminality frame. But in the fishing frame, out goes the bait, catch the fish. The fish bites the bait, and that's it. It's on the hook. It's one clear fisher person, one fish, one bite, clear consequences. So it's very tightly compressed at human scale, right? And that is, in fact, the way this blend was used, to warn men, wait a minute, you're starting to get into something here and you might not see what's going on, and to warn them off and say, no, this girl is jailbait, because then the guy is the fish, and you don't want to be caught on the hook, right? Only she's jailbait. She's going to put you in jail. Right? Now, interestingly, you get a lot of emergent structure. So the fish does not know, for example, that it wants, you know, to bite the hook. In fact, it doesn't want to bite the hook. But what you're doing is telling the guy that he's about to bite the hook in the blend. And, of course, in the fisherman frame, the fisherman very much wants to catch the fish, right? Whereas it might be that the girl had no interest in this at all. But you can play around with it, with these selective projections. Now, I've started off here with poetry and idiom, but what I want to say is that we use this frame blending all the time to make major decisions about finances, about politics, about national identities, and about the self. There was an argument made, it's a famous argument in political science. If Churchill had been prime minister in 1938 instead of Neville Chamberlain, Hitler would have been deposed and World War II averted. Remember, Neville Chamberlain was prime minister of Great Britain at the time, and Churchill was not. Now, what this blend is getting you to do is to take one frame in which there's Churchill, and at the time he was regarded as having bad judgment and kind of extreme. It was not possible in 1938 that Winston Churchill would have become prime minister. Instead, Neville Chamberlain was prime minister, and Neville Chamberlain, as we know, is said to have followed the path of appeasement. He did not try to make Hitler back down. Now, we have another frame in which Winston Churchill is celebrated as the great leader of England against, you know, we have nothing to fear but fear ourselves. Never have so many owed so much to so few, right? Okay, so you can take the Churchill from later, that character, and the role prime minister from 1938 and put them together, and now notice the amazing emergent structure. Now Churchill is prime minister in 1938, and instead of appeasement, he confronts Hitler directly, threatens, right? Has great spine. And a wonderful emergent structure, Hitler backs down, right? Now, you may think that this is just retrospect, but so here, you know, not only is World War II averted in this frame blend, but there's no Holocaust, right? Now, here's some aspects of blending. Blending exploits counterpart connections between the two frames, right? So there is a Churchill in one frame and in the other, right? They're very different, but there's an identity link between them. There's also a frame in each of them of a national leader, a prime minister, leading a country, and there are frames of war and so on. It just so happens that in one of these situations, Neville Chamberlain is the prime minister, and the other one, Winston Churchill, is the prime minister. So counterparts may or may not be brought into the blend. So Neville Chamberlain and Winston Churchill are both counterparts, but Neville Chamberlain is not brought into the blend. We bring Hitler into the blend, and he's the same Hitler in both spaces, despite the fact that he's a very, very different Hitler in the blend. Right? Now he's a Hitler who backs down. The projection from the influencing spaces is selective. You can see that. Only certain things are brought down. And there's tremendous knowledge that we have about power-maximizing actors and so on that doesn't even have to be mentioned at all that we recruit. And this process can be applied repeatedly. So somebody could say, oh, that's only because Hitler was irrational. A more rational Hitler would have seen that his strategic chances were still excellent and would not have backed down. So now we have Hitler blended with a more rational frame for a politician. Now we've got a rational Hitler in the blend. And guess what? Now Hitler doesn't back down, but for completely different reasons than the historic Hitler backed down. And if you just listen to discourse, what you'll see is these blends upon blends upon blends, where a blend is an input to the next integration structure. And this is completely effortless for people. Margaret Thatcher, in talking about the aggressors in former Yugoslavia, called up this previous blend. Essentially, what she said, not in so many words, was, well, if Churchill had been prime minister, Hitler would have backed down. And we need to be just like that in Yugoslavia. We should not appease the aggressors. We need to just go right in so we won't have atrocities and war crimes. And you have to understand, this is now a prime minister of Great Britain. So very much like Churchill, right? Very, very much in that role, using this counterfactual blend as an argument for why they have to go to war in Yugoslavia. This is not after the fact punishment of Dante, of Bertrand de Born. This is not Seabiscuit. This is, hey, I'm going to send a whole nation to war. The Western allies need to go to war, and here's why, right? So very serious inferencing on the basis of these blends. So I'll skip over that. Projection back to the influencing space, and so on. Now here's a crucial point about frame blending. The purpose of frame blending is sometimes to build a model that we can follow in the world. But sometimes it's to get, it is not to be a possible world, it's to get us to think about decisions. So here's another gruesome case. There was a woman who was in a coma, and she was in a nursing home. And she went in when she was 20 years old, because she was in a coma. And she was raped while she was in the coma and got pregnant. Right? Now, what a dilemma. What do you decide to do? Right? And so the courts were trying to figure out what to do. This is a real human question of life and choice and the future and judgment and justice. Now, it happened that one side said, well, we knew that when she was 19, she was pro-life. That means she opposed abortion. One of the other law professors said, even if everyone agrees that she, that's the comatose woman, was pro-life at age 19, she is now 29 and has lived in persistent vegetative state, that's a coma, for 10 years. Do we ask, was she pro-life back then 10 years ago? Or do we more appropriately ask, would she be pro-life as a rape victim in a persistent vegetative state at 29 years of life? Now, think of that blend. In the blend, there's a woman who's pregnant because she was raped while she was in a coma. She's still in a coma, but she's thinking about the fact that she's a person in a coma. This is what we call P and not P. She is thinking and aware of the fact that she is not thinking and not aware. And far from anybody saying, oh, this is pointless silliness. No, this gets us to think about, or at least it was put forward to get us to think about, what it means for a woman to have a choice when she's in a coma, right? And we don't have to side with any one side or the other to see this use of frame blending to try to get us to make decisions about very crucial things. I will just say that Shauna Colson found a wonderful example in 1992. It was written by Lee Easel. I say thanks that no Planned Parenthood clinic, that's where you could get an abortion, was available to me in 1963 when as a virgin teenager I was raped and became pregnant. The state of California would have been taking advantage of me in my crisis state by offering me this seemingly easy out. As an unwanted child myself, I decided abortion was too permanent a solution to my temporary problem. Now, we have since analyzed this to say that there's a great range of frame blends upon frame blends upon frame blends in this. Nobody has any difficulty understanding that at all. Nobody thought this was unintelligible or strange. No, putting together these kinds of elaborate mental integration networks with blend upon blend upon blend is just what we're built for. It's the easiest thing that we can do. You need the counterfactual blend in which Lee's mother did not have the child. Lee. In that case, Lee would not have existed. You have, remember, she was an unwanted child herself. You need the counterfactual blend in which Lee in 1963 was not raped and therefore did not have Julie. That's the child that gets referred to later in the article. The space in which it is 1992 and there are Planned Parenthood clinics providing abortions to teenage rape victims. The space in which it's 1963. I won't go on. The point is, to have followed that argument, you needed to put all of these different frame blends together and use some of them as inputs to the others. Otherwise, you can't get the right kinds of inferences. You don't realize that you're doing it, but so what? You don't realize that 50% of cerebral cortex is implicated in vision and that you're doing fabulous amounts of work just to see the color blue. Fabulous amounts of work that you can't even pull into consciousness. It's mostly that way with language and meaning. We are not built with our mental operations to be able to analyze language or meaning. We're built to use them. What we're trying to do is to take thin little capacities that we have and trick them to looking at language. So in fact, almost none of what we are doing when we understand something or when we use language are we aware of, or in some cases can be aware of. Here's one. You know, I started off with poetry and jokes, sort of to lull you into thinking that this was about poetry and jokes, but now what you're seeing is that I'm talking about World War II and what you do with a rape victim and political policy. Here's one that cost billions and billions of dollars. Justice William O. Douglas of the Supreme Court, writing on why the Federal Urban Renewal Program was constitutional. This was a program that went into neighborhoods and knocked down buildings that were just fine, ripped up roads that were just fine, despite the fact that those buildings were privately owned. Now, in the United States, this is something truly amazing, to have the government come in and knock down a building that's privately owned. What right would the government have to do that? That's almost unheard of. You can only do it with something that's called eminent domain. And so this went all the way to our Supreme Court. Was this constitutional? And he said, well, the experts concluded that if the community were to be healthy, if it were not to revert again to a blighted or slum area, as though possessed of a congenital disease, then we had to do the whole thing. What he's doing is taking the frame of urban life and buildings and the frame of a crop that is blighted with a disease. Now, what you do with the crop is you have to cut everything down, till it under, wait for the infecting little organisms to die, and then you plant the crop again with healthy seed. That's completely unlike the urban scene, right? If you were just to say this as an analogy, you would say, oh, I see. Over here in blight, we cut down the whole crop so that all of the residents on the crop die. And so over here in the city, what we're going to do is knock down all the buildings so all of the citizens die and won't come back? No, that's not. That would be the analogy, but that's not what we want at all. In the blend, what you now get is that you're knocking down the crop so that the crop comes back healthy, but not that you're trying to get rid of the residents, right? And in fact, in the blight, you replant the same crop again, but that's exactly what they're not going to do in the city. They're not going to rebuild everything exactly the way it was. But This was the basis of a decision that made an act by the federal government constitutional that otherwise would not have been, and that cost billions of dollars over time, right? A frame blend. Skip over this one. Now, we've talked an awful lot about polysemy, and I'm just going to sum up here some of what we've said before, that expressions that are implied to an input can be projected to apply to counterparts in the blend. And in this way, the blend harnesses existing words in order to express new meanings that arise in the blend. So for instance, if you make a frame blend between a virus that attacks the body and something that does bad things to your computer, and in the blend you have this bad thing and you use the word virus because you have projected that down from one of the frames, now you can say, I got a virus from your email message, right? Perfectly fine. That word now is used to refer to this kind of thing, and it can become entrenched. Easiest thing in the world. We'll talk about number in a minute. Same-sex marriage. Now there are movements all over the United States to allow marriage between man and man or woman and woman, right? Okay. So marriage, which was something between a man and a woman, now gets projected down into the blend of same-sex marriage, obviously two quite different frames. And marriage can apply to that thing that's in the blend. For numbers, you can start off with numbers and blend them with points on a line and containers, and then you get a number line with zero because the container can have nothing in it. Notice The counting numbers themselves don't have a zero. But the point is, now zero counts as a number. Previously it wasn't a number, but now polysemy comes in. Zero is a number. And it's the same thing with rational numbers. When you blend in proportions with number lines with zero and you get rational numbers, now rational numbers are numbers. And when you take segments that allow you to get irrational lengths, now you have the real numbers that include irrationals. And when you take arcs that are approximated by segments and blend them in with rational and irrational numbers, you can get transcendental numbers, numbers with transcendentals. And when you take the line in space with rotation, now you can get negative numbers. You get real numbers out of that. And when you combine real numbers with two-dimensional space, as we've analyzed in the way we think, you can get complex numbers. Now, the important point of this is that the internal structure of what a number is changes as you blend upon blend upon blend, but you keep the word. Complex numbers, these wild things, are now numbers, just like one and two, right? You don't need new words to refer to enormously new creative meaning. Number just goes all along. We saw polysemy with a word like father. So Paul is the father of Sally, where you have the kinship frame blended with Paul and Sally. This is a simplex blend. It's just framing. It's a normal kind of thing to do. But Zeus was the father of Sarpedon, because Zeus is immortal. But now you can have an immortal father in the blend and still call him father. Zeus is the father of Athena. There's no mother, and she's born fully clad in armor from his brow. But father in the blend can refer to that scene. Joseph was the father of Jesus. The Pope is the father of all Catholics. George Washington is the father of our country. Fear is the father of cruelty. The child is father of the man. The same word father, because it's in an input space, can be projected down to its counterpart in the blend and then applied to that meaning that's been constructed in the blend. Principle number two, combinations of expressions from the inputs may be appropriate for picking out structure in the blend, even though those combinations are inappropriate grammatically for the inputs. So in number, for example, before you had complex numbers, before you had imaginary numbers, you had words like the square root and other phrases like negative one. But the square root of negative one had no meaning. It had no application. It wasn't grammatical, because you could only take square roots of non-negative numbers. But when you get complex numbers, now the square root of negative one picks out something in the blend. We abbreviate this by I now, right? Combinations of expressions from the inputs can be used to pick out elements in the blend that have no counterparts in the inputs, and it's just fine. So if same-sex marriage is established everywhere, later on I'll be able to say things like the brides married each other at noon, and that'll be perfectly fine. And it won't mean a double wedding between, you know, two grooms and two brides, right? It can now mean, the brides can now mean the agents who are getting married, if that works. Principle number three, we often have terms for emergent structure in the blend and can use them even though those terms cannot be applied to the inputs themselves. So you saw the debate with Kant. You know, Kant has no answer for me, right? That's perfectly grammatical for human conversation, but it can't apply to the inputs where the modern philosopher is talking about Kant 2 centuries ago, 3 centuries ago. But it can apply to the blend, because in the blend, Kant and the philosopher are engaged in a debate. And the last one, which is really sort of a summary of the first one, blending routinely and inevitably extends the use of words. We saw this in things like safe, where we need to take one scene and then use a frame of harm, blend them to create a scene of harm, specific scene, understand that that scene is counterfactual with respect to the one that we're in, compress that counterfactual link into a particular condition in our scene, which is new, which is absence of harm. And now that's what the word safe is asking you to do. It's to do a standard kind of frame blend. I won't go through that again. Fictivity. Fictivity is a major component of human languages, studied by a number of people, Lynn Talmy, Esther Pascual, Ana Margarita Abrantes, and so on. So let's just look at some of the most famous ones, Talmy's fictive motion blends. Talmy points out that we say things like, the mountain range goes all the way from Mexico to Canada. Now, of course, mountain ranges don't go. They're static. And you can't explain this as metonymy, that is, the road goes all the way down to the beach. There the idea is that somebody can walk along the road and they're going. And so when you say the road goes, it's really metonymic for the somebody who goes. But there is no road in the mountain range across the top, and there's certainly nobody who walks it from Mexico to Canada. But you can imagine that there is a frame in which something goes from a source to a target, from an origin to a destination along a path. We do it all the time. And here's a static scene, namely the mountain range, and you can blend them, and in the blend you have fictive motion. And in this case, Mexico is mapped to the beginning point, the origin of the path. Canada is mapped to the end point of the path. And you notice you don't have to say across the United States. You don't even have to mention that at all, right? This is just the standard way to refer to things like this because of fictive motion. He gives a kind of taxonomy. There are a few others, access paths. The bakery is across the street from the bank. Okay, now, across is a word from the frame of motion along a path. It can be applied in the blend. And the path now corresponds to the street. The street is the word that we bring down from the static scene. And it can apply to, it can pick out the path. Notice, interestingly, the bakery is across the street from the bank, and the bank is across the street from the bakery, should mean exactly the same kind of thing. And indeed, in a way, they do, but they ask you for very different construals of where you're standing and what you're seeing, right? Other kinds of paths are advent paths. The palm trees clustered together around the oasis. Now, nobody thinks, unless this is, you know, Lord of the Rings or Macbeth, nobody thinks that trees can walk, right, and that they move or that they cluster. But here the in-state, the configuration of the palm trees is taken as the in-state of several paths of motion, right? And you understand what it means. These are advent paths. Another one that I like very much is, as I painted the ceiling, paint spots slowly progressed across the floor. Now, there is motion in the painting scene. You're moving your hand, and the paint drops are falling. But the important motion is not those in the blend. It's the paint drops themselves don't move across the floor. But when you see, it's like a series of lights. If this one goes on, then 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 this one goes on. No light is moving, but you can't help seeing it as sweeping a path in time. And you say, wow, the light went across, right? Even though, of course, it didn't. That's a fictive blend. Shadow paths, the tree threw its shadow down the valley. All of these are cases in which you get fabulous fictive change, fictive motion, fictive interaction. So in fictive change, we saw things like the fences get bigger as you travel across the United States. And you don't mean any fence actually gets bigger. What you mean is as you go farther on, each fence is disanalogous to earlier fences because it's a little bigger. Lots of fictive change. Dinosaurs turned into birds. The red light turned green when, of course, it didn't do any such thing. The red light was the red light and the green light was the green light, and they are separate. Fictive motion, fictive interaction, debate with Kant, the mythic race with all these people who are now racing against each other, the regatta where the catamaran is racing against the clipper ship, and so on. That is, we create in the blend these human-scale scenarios of change for an object, of interaction between two objects of two or two people, of motion, for something that is static, of conversation between things that are not actually conversing in the inputs. And that blend gives us meaning that helps us understand the network. And we also have words to refer to that meaning because we can project them down from the inputs. Remember, talking to the ashes, you, brother, your mute ashes, right? Very, very easy. Now that I've done all the serious things in the world, after starting off with the funny poetry, let's go back just a little bit to the poetry. Remember I mentioned the runaway bunny. There's a little bunny. Talking animals are the mainstay of every nursery, and this is, of course, a frame blend. A human being talks, an animal doesn't talk, and actually, and the stuffed object is not even alive. But in the blend, there's a stuffed object that talks, and it's an animal. So you get a little stuffed bunny, and children play with it, and so on. And so there's a talking bunny, and the runaway bunny says, I'm going to run away. It's a book for two-year-olds. And the mother says, well, if you run away, I'll come after you, for you are my little bunny. And he says, if you come after me, I'll turn into a fish and swim away. And there's a little picture of the bunny jumping in the water. And the mother says, well, if you become a fish, I'll become a fisherman and I will catch you. And he says, well, if you become a fisherman and you catch me, then I'll become a flower high on the mountain. She says, if you become a flower high on the mountain, I'll become a mountain climber and I will find you, for you are my little bunny. And it goes all the way through this, right? Now, in fact, there's something very similar. In 1858, Nobel Prize winner Frédéric Mistral has a work called Mireille, in which he embeds the Provençal song, O Magali. And in O Magali, there's a suitor who's singing to Magali up in her balcony, right? And he says, be mine. He plays the guitar. She says, then I will become a cloud and float away to America. I love that one. And he says, then I will become the sea breeze and carry you. And you see very many of these in the Runaway Bunny. And now, this goes on and on and on. And finally, after this long, long series, she says, you'll never catch me, so on. You know, I'm going to go into the convent and become a nun, a novetto, a little, apprentice nun. And he says, if you do that, I'll become a priest, and I'll be your confessor and hear you. And she says, this is the big one. If you pass through the portal of the convent, that's the nunnery where no men can get in and so on, you will find all the nuns walking in a circle around me because you will see me laid out under a shroud. And essentially she says, I'll kill myself if you keep this up. You know, you'd think rhetorically that would stop somebody, right? Certainly would today. And he says, if you become the poor dead girl, I will therefore become the earth. And then I shall have you, because she's not going to be cremated, she's going to be buried in the earth. Now, she then says, now I begin to believe that you are not merely engaging in pleasantries with me. Here's my little glass ring for remembrance, handsome young man. Okay, now here's the last point I want to make. The frame blends that you see here, it's very easy to sort of see the blends. There's the fish, here's the girl, here's the cloud, here's the breeze, and so on. You can do them again and again and again. Fine. But stay attentive and watch for blends, because there's a kind of blend that's happening in Runaway Bunny and Magali, which is a blend for the purposes of rhetorical persuasion. What do I mean? Well, what I mean is, when you're a child, when you're a two-year-old child thinking about the future, there's nobody who can literally guarantee you a future of security. You have to live it. Things happen. And it takes a long time and involves many agents. And when you're dating somebody, courting somebody, and thinking about getting married, naturally people are going to be concerned about whether or not this will work. You know, will this marriage be a good one, right? And you can't know just by running it. You can't say, oh, I see. I'll marry this guy for 30 years, and if it doesn't work, I'll just go back to the way I was when I was 19 or 26. Right? There's some things you can't just rewind, but you'd like to know. Okay, there's a pattern that we all use, and that is, hello? Have I gone over time? Let's try this. There's a pattern that we all use. Yeah, I'd rather have that one. Wonderful. So there's a pattern that we all use, and that is to take the structure of the discourse interaction, which can happen right now, in 2 minutes in the cafe. It can happen in 1 hour over dinner. The structure of the, it can happen when a mother is reading a story to a little child. It's brief, and there are just two of you. And it can happen right now. To take the structure and the dynamism and the psychology from that little frame of discourse and to blend it with the huge life events that we're really thinking about. So notice what happens in both Runaway Bunny and Oh My Golly. The child and the beloved keep saying they're going to get away. And rhetorically, what they do is say, I'll become such and such. In other words, they have the right to throw themselves into a new frame. Over here, I'm this thing in this frame. And then the mother, Bunny, and the suitor have to throw them, they have to throw, find a way to throw themselves into that frame. It's pretty easy with the fish. You become a fish, I'll become a fisherman. You become a cloud, float away to America? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Ah, I'll become the breeze. Notice that rhetorically, inventively, the mother and the suitor stay with, conceptually, they stay with the child and the beloved. Every time, rhetorically, they put themselves into a new frame, the mother or the suitor finds a way, invents a way to insert themselves into that frame. So, for instance, the suitor can't say, oh, don't be ridiculous, you'll never become a cloud. You know, if he does that, what happens? What happens? That's the end of it. He's not getting anywhere, right? He has to stay with it. So they both show that discursively and imaginatively, they will, and linguistically, they will stay with the person that they're pursuing, and that tenacity and loyalty, if you will, gets projected into the blend, that ability to deal with whatever you throw at that person. You throw something at mother, mother will find a way. You throw something at the suitor will find a way. That becomes persuasive, or is taken as a signal of persuasion, because in the blend, the structure of the discourse is the structure of the life that they're talking about. So the little bunny says at the end, shucks, I'll never get away. I might as well stay here, be your little bunny. And mother says, have a carrot, right? And at the end of Oh My Golly, the girl says, hey, I see now that you're not just toying with me. Here's my little ring, which is a symbol all in itself. So frame blends, in fact, often the ones that are most persuasive and most important are the ones that we don't even notice, but that are having tremendous effect on us. Thank you very much.